anyone else to find it. 3. Mrs. Stapleton tells Dr. Watson to go straight back to London instantly. This is because she thinks Dr. Watson is Sir Henry Baskerville, and she knows that her husband wants to kill him. And these are some of the red herrings. 1. Sherlock Holmes and Watson are followed when they're in London by a man in a coach with a black beard. This makes you think that the man is Barrymore, who's the caretaker at Baskerville Hall, because he's the only other person who has a black beard. But the man is really Stapleton, who's wearing a false beard. 2. Selden, the Notting Hill murderer. This is a man who has escaped from a prison nearby and is being hunted down on the moors, which makes you think that he has something to do with the story, because he is a criminal, but he isn't anything to do with the story at all. 3. The man on the tor. This is a silhouette of a man that Dr. Watson sees on the moor at night and doesn't recognise, which makes you think it's the murderer, but it's Sherlock Holmes who has come to Devon secretly. I also like The Hound of the Baskervilles because I like Sherlock Holmes, and I think that if I were a proper detective, he's the kind of detective I would be. He's very intelligent, and he solves the mystery, and he says, "The world is full of obvious things which nobody by any chance ever observes. But he notices them, like I do." Also, it says in the book, "Sherlock Holmes had, in a very remarkable degree, the power of detaching his mind at will." And this is like me too, because if I get really interested in something, like practicing maths, or reading a book about the Apollo missions, or great white sharks, I don't notice anything else, and Father can be calling me to come and eat my supper and I won't hear him. And this is why I'm very good at playing chess, because I detach my mind at will and concentrate on the board. And after a while, the person I'm playing will stop concentrating and start scratching their nose or staring out the window. And then they'll make a mistake, and I'll win. Also, Dr. Watson says about Sherlock Holmes, "His mind was busy in endeavouring to frame some scheme into which all these strange and apparently disconnected episodes could be fitted." And that's what I'm trying to do by writing this book. Also, Sherlock Holmes doesn't believe in the supernatural, which is God and fairy tales and hounds of hell and curses, which are stupid things. And I'm going to finish this chapter with two interesting facts about Sherlock Holmes. 1. In the original Sherlock Holmes stories, Sherlock Holmes is never described as wearing a deerstalker hat, which is what he's always wearing in pictures and cartoons. The deerstalker hat was invented by a man called Sidney Paget, who did the illustrations for the original books. 2. In the Sherlock Holmes stories, Sherlock Holmes never says, "Elementary, my dear Watson." He only ever says this in films and on television. Chapter 109. That night, I wrote some more of my book, and the next morning I took it into school so that Siobhan could read it and tell me if I'd made mistakes with the spelling and the grammar. Siobhan read the book during morning break when she has a cup of coffee and sits at the edge of the playground with the other teachers. And after morning break, she came and sat down next to me and said she had read the bit about my conversation with Mrs. Alexander, and she said, "Have you told your father about this?" And I replied, "No." And she said, "Are you going to tell your father about this?" And I replied, "No." And she said, "Good. I think that's a good idea, Christopher." And then she said, "Did it make you sad to find this out?" And I asked, "Find what out?" And she said, "Did it make you upset to find out that your mother and Mr. Shears had an affair?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Are you telling the truth, Christopher?" And then I said, "I always tell the truth." And she said, "I know you do, Christopher, but sometimes we get sad about things, and we don't like to tell other people that we are sad about them. We like to keep it a secret. Or sometimes we're sad, but we don't really know we're sad. So we say we aren't sad, but we really are." And I said, I'm not sad. And she said, if you do start to feel sad about this, I want you to know that you can come and talk to me about it. Because I think talking to me will help you feel less sad. And if you don't feel sad, but you just want to talk to me about it, that would be okay too. Do you understand? And I said, I understand. And she said, good. And I replied, but I don't feel sad about it, because Mother's dead, and because Mr. Shears isn't around anymore. So I would be feeling sad about something that isn't real and doesn't exist. And that would be stupid. And then I practiced maths for the rest of the morning. And at lunch, I didn't have the quiche because it was yellow, but I did have the carrots and the peas and lots of tomato ketchup. And for afters, I had some blackberry and apple crumble, but not the crumble bit because that was yellow too, and I got Mrs. Davis to take the crumble bit off before she put it onto my plate, because it doesn't matter if different sorts of food are touching before they're actually on your plate. Then, after lunch, I spent the afternoon doing art with Mrs. Peters, and I painted some pictures of aliens. Chapter 113. My memory is like a film. That's why I'm really good at remembering things, like the conversations I've written down in this book, and what people were wearing, and what they smelled like, because my memory has a smell track, which is like a soundtrack. And when people ask me to remember something, I can simply press rewind and fast forward and pause, like on a video recorder, but more like a DVD, because I don't have to rewind through everything in between to get to a memory of something a long time ago. And there are no buttons either, because it's happening in my head. If someone says to me, Christopher, tell me what your mother was like, I can rewind to lots of different scenes and say what she was like in those scenes. For example, I could rewind to 4th July 1992 when I was 9 years old, which was a Saturday, and we were on holiday in Cornwall, and in the afternoon we were on the beach in a place called Polperro, and Mother was wearing a pair of shorts made out of denim and a light blue bikini top, and she was smoking cigarettes called Consulate, which were mint flavour. And she wasn't swimming. Mother was sunbathing on a towel which had red and purple stripes, and she was reading a book by Georgette Heyer called The Masqueraders. And then she finished sunbathing and went into the water to swim, and she said, "Bloody Nora, it's cold!" And she said, "I should come and swim too, but I don't like swimming because I don't like taking my clothes off." And she said I should just roll up my trousers and walk into the water a little way, so I did. And I stood in the water. And Mother said, "Look, it's lovely." And she jumped backwards and disappeared under the water. And I thought a shark had eaten her, and I screamed. And she stood up out of the water again and came over to where I was standing and held up her right hand and spread her fingers out in a fan and said, "Come on, Christopher, touch my hand. Come on now, stop screaming. Touch my hand. Listen to me, Christopher, you can do it." And after a while I stopped screaming and held up my left hand and spread my fingers out in a fan, and we made our fingers and our thumbs touch each other. And Mother said, "It's okay, Christopher, it's okay. There aren't any sharks in Cornwall." And then I felt better. Except I can't remember anything before I was about 4, because I wasn't looking at things in the right way before then, so they didn't get recorded properly. And this is how I recognise someone if I don't know who they are. I see what they're wearing, or if they have a walking stick, or funny hair, or a certain type of glasses, or they have a particular way of moving their arms, and I do a search through my memories to see if I've met them before. And this is also how I know how to act in difficult situations when I don't know what to do. For example, if people say things which don't make sense, like, "See you later, alligator," or "You'll catch your death in that," I do a search and see if I've ever heard someone say this before. And if someone is lying on the floor at school, I do a search through my memory to find a picture of someone having an epileptic fit, and then I compare the picture with what's happening in front of me, so I can decide whether they're just lying down and playing a game, or having a sleep, or whether they're having an epileptic fit. And if they are having an epileptic fit, I move any furniture out of the way to stop them banging their head, and I take my jumper off and I put it underneath their head and I go and find a teacher. Other people have pictures in their heads too, but they're different because the pictures in my head are all pictures of things which really happened. But other people have pictures in their heads of things which aren't real and didn't happen. For example, sometimes Mother used to say, "If I hadn't married your father, I think I'd be living in a little farmhouse in the south of France with someone called Jean. And he'd be, oh, a local handyman, you know, doing painting and decorating for people, gardening, building fences. And we'd have a veranda with figs growing over it. And there'd be a field of sunflowers at the bottom of the garden and a little town on the hill in the distance. And we'd sit outside in the evening and drink red wine and smoke Gauloise cigarettes and watch the sun go down." And Siobhan once said that when she felt depressed or sad, she'd close her eyes and she'd imagine that she was staying in a house on Cape Cod with her friend Ellie, and they'd take a trip on a boat from Provincetown and go out into the bay to watch the humpback whales, and that made her feel calm and peaceful and happy. And sometimes, when someone has died, like Mother died, people say, "What would you want to say to your mother if she was here now?" Or, "What would your mother think about that?" Which is stupid, because Mother's dead, and you can't say anything to people who are dead, and dead people can't think. And Grandmother has pictures in her head too, but her pictures are all confused, like someone's muddled the film up and she can't tell what happened in what order, so she thinks that dead people are still alive, and she doesn't know whether something happened in real life or whether it happened on television. Chapter 127. When I got home from school, Father was still out at work, so I unlocked the front door and went inside and took my coat off. I went into the kitchen and put my things on the table, and one of the things was this book which I had taken into school to show to Siobhan. I made myself a raspberry milkshake and heated it up in the microwave, and then went through to the living room to watch one of my Blue Planet videos about life in the deepest parts of the ocean. The video was about the sea creatures who live around sulfur chimneys, which are underwater volcanoes where gases are ejected from the Earth's crust into the water. Scientists never expected there to be any living organisms there because it was so hot and so poisonous, but there are whole ecosystems there. I like this bit because it shows you that there's always something new that science can discover, and all the facts that you take for granted can be completely wrong. And also, I like the fact that they're filming in a place which is harder to get to than the top of Mount Everest, but is only a few miles away from sea level. And it's one of the quietest and darkest and most secret places on the surface of the Earth. And I like imagining that I'm there sometimes, in a spherical metal submersible with windows that are 30 centimetres thick to stop them from imploding under the pressure. And I imagine that I am the only person inside it, and that it's not connected to a ship at all, but it can operate under its own power. And I can control the motors and move anywhere I want to on the seabed, and I can never be found. Father came home at 5:48 p.m. I heard him come through the front door. Then he came into the living room. He was wearing a lime green and sky blue check shirt, and there was a double knot on one of his shoes, but not on the other. He was carrying an old advert for Fussell's milk powder, which was made of metal and painted with blue and white enamel and covered with little circles of rust which were like bullet holes, but he didn't explain why he was carrying this. He said, "Howdy, pardner," which is a joke he does. And I said, "Hello." I carried on watching the video, and Father went into the kitchen. I had forgotten that I had left my book lying on the kitchen table because I was too interested in the Blue Planet video. This is what is called relaxing your guard, and it's what you must never do if you're a detective. It was 5:54 p.m. when Father came back into the living room. He said, "What is this?" But he said it very quietly, and I didn't realise that he was angry because he wasn't shouting. He was holding the book in his right hand. I said, "It's a book I'm writing." And he said, "Is this true?" Did you talk to Mrs. Alexander? He said this very quietly as well, so I still didn't realise that he was angry. And I said, yes. Then he said, holy fucking Jesus, Christopher, how stupid are you? This is what Siobhan says is called a rhetorical question. It has a question mark at the end, but you're not meant to answer it because the person who's asking it already knows the answer. It's difficult to spot a rhetorical question. Then Father said, what the fuck did I tell you, Christopher? This was much louder. And I replied, not to mention Mr. Shear's name in our house, and not to go asking Mrs. Shears or anyone about who killed that bloody dog, and not to go trespassing in other people's gardens and to stop this ridiculous bloody detective game. Except I haven't done any of those things. I just asked Mrs. Alexander about Mr. Shears because... But Father interrupted me and said, don't give me that bollocks, you little shit. You knew exactly what you were bloody doing. I've read the book, remember? And when he said this, he held up the book and shook it. What else did I say, Christopher? I thought that this might be another rhetorical question, but I wasn't sure. I found it hard to work out what to say because I was starting to get scared and confused. Then Father repeated the question. What else did I say, Christopher? I said, I don't know. And he said, come on, you're the fucking memory man. I couldn't think. And Father said, not to go around sticking your fucking nose into other people's business. And what do? You go around sticking your nose into other people's business. You go around raking up the past and sharing it with every Tom, Dick and Harry you bump into. What am I going to do with you, Christopher? What the fuck am I going to do with you? I said, I was just doing chatting with Mrs. Alexander. I wasn't doing investigating. And he said, I ask you to do one thing for me, Christopher. One thing. And I said, I didn't want to talk to Mrs. Alexander. It was Mrs. Alexander who... But Father interrupted me and grabbed hold of my arm really hard. Father had never grabbed hold of me like that before. Mother had hit me sometimes because she was a very hot-tempered person, which means that she got angry more quickly than other people and she shouted more often. But Father is a more level-headed person, which means he doesn't get angry as quickly and he doesn't shout as often. So I was very surprised when he grabbed me. I don't like it when people grab me, and I don't like being surprised either, so I hit him. Like I hit the policeman when he took hold of my arms and lifted me onto my feet. But Father didn't let go and he was shouting. And I hit him again. And then I didn't know what I was doing anymore. I had no memories for a short while. I know it was a short while because I checked my watch afterwards. It was like someone had switched me off and then switched me on again. And when they switched me on again, I was sitting on the carpet with my back against the wall and there was blood on my right hand and the side of my head was hurting. And Father was standing on the carpet a meter in front of me, looking down at me, and he was still holding my book in his right hand, but it was bent in half and all the corners were messed up and there was a scratch on his neck and a big rip in the sleeve of his green and blue check shirt and he was breathing really deeply. After about a minute, he turned and he walked through to the kitchen. Then he unlocked the back door into the garden and went outside. I heard him lift the lid of the dustbin and drop something into it and put the lid of the dustbin back on. Then he came back into the kitchen again, but he wasn't carrying the book anymore. Then he locked the back door and put the key into the little china jug that shaped like a fat nun, and he stood in the middle of the kitchen and closed his eyes. Then he opened his eyes and he said, I need a fucking drink. And he got himself a can of beer. Chapter 131. These are some of the reasons why I hate yellow and brown. Yellow. 1. Custard.
2. Bananas. Bananas also turn brown. 3. Double yellow lines. 4. Yellow fever, which is a disease from tropical America and West Africa, which causes a high fever, acute nephritis, jaundice and hemorrhages. And it's caused by a virus transmitted by the bite of a mosquito called Aedes aegypti, which used to be called Stegomyia fasciata, and nephritis is inflammation of the kidneys. 5. Yellow flowers, because I get hay fever from flower pollen, which is one of 3 sorts of hay fever, and the others are from grass pollen and fungus pollen, and it makes me feel ill. 6. Sweet corn, because it comes out in your poo and you don't digest it, so you're not really meant to eat it, like grass or leaves. Brown. 1. Dirt. 2. Gravy. 3. Poo. 4. Wood. Because people used to make machines and vehicles out of wood, but they don't anymore because wood breaks and goes rotten and has worms in sometimes, and now people make machines and vehicles out of metal and plastic, which are much better and more modern. 5. Melissa Brown, who is a girl at school, who is not actually brown like Anil or Mohammed. It's just her name, but she tore my big astronaut painting into 2 pieces and I threw it away, even after Mrs. Peters sellotaped it together again, because it looked broken. Mrs. Forbes said that hating yellow and brown is just being silly, and Siobhan said that she shouldn't say things like that, and everyone has favourite colours. And Siobhan was right, but Mrs. Forbes was a bit right too. Because it is sort of being silly. But in life, you have to take lots of decisions, and if you don't take decisions, you would never do anything, because you'd spend all your time choosing between things you could do. So it's good to have a reason why you hate some things and you like others. It's like being in a restaurant, like when Father takes me out to a Burnie Inn sometimes, and you look at the menu and you have to choose what you're going to have. But you don't know if you're going to like something because you haven't tasted it yet. So you have favourite foods and you choose these. And you have foods you don't like and you don't choose these. And then it's simple. Chapter 137. The next day, Father said he was sorry that he had hit me, and he didn't mean to. He made me wash the cut on my cheek with Dettol to make sure that it wasn't infected. Then he got me to put a plaster on it so it didn't bleed. Then, because it was a Saturday, he said he was going to take me on an expedition to show me that he was properly sorry, and we were going to Twycross Zoo. So he made me some sandwiches with white bread and tomatoes and lettuce and ham and strawberry jam for me to eat, because I don't like eating food from places I don't know. And he said it would be okay, because there wouldn't be too many people at the zoo because it was forecast to rain. And I was glad about that, because I don't like crowds of people and I like it when it's raining. So I went and got my waterproof, which is orange. Then we drove to Twycross Zoo. I had never been to Twycross Zoo before, so I didn't have a picture of it in my mind before we got there. So we bought a guidebook from the information centre, and then we walked round the whole zoo, and I decided which were my favourite animals. My favourite animals were 1. Randy Man, which is the name of the oldest red-faced black spider monkey, Ateles paniscus paniscus, ever kept in captivity. Randy Man is 44 years old, which is the same age as Father. He used to be a pet on a ship and have a metal band round his stomach, like in a story about pirates. 2. The Patagonian sea lions, which are called Miracle and Star. 3. Maliku, which is an orangutan. I liked it especially because it was lying in a kind of hammock made out of a pair of stripy green pyjama bottoms, and on the blue plastic notice next to the cage, it said it made the hammock itself. Then we went to the cafe, and Father had plaice and chips and apple pie and ice cream and a pot of Earl Grey tea, and I had my sandwiches, and I read the guidebook to the zoo. And Father said, "I love you very much, Christopher. Don't ever forget that. And I know I lose my rag occasionally. I know I get angry, I know I shout, and I know I shouldn't, but I only do it because I worry about you, because I don't want to see you getting into trouble, because I don't want you to get hurt. Do you understand?" I didn't know whether I understood, so I said, "I don't know." And Father said, "Christopher, do you understand that I love you?" And I said, "Yes, because loving someone is helping them when they get into trouble and looking after them and telling them the truth. And Father looks after me when I get into trouble, like coming to the police station. And he looks after me by cooking meals for me. And he always tells me the truth, which means that he loves me." And then he held up his right hand and spread his fingers out in a fan. And I held up my left hand and spread my fingers out in a fan. And we made our fingers and thumbs touch each other. Then I got out a piece of paper from my bag and I did a map of the zoo from memory as a test. Then we went and looked at the giraffes. And the smell of their poo was like the smell inside the gerbil cage at school when we had gerbils. And when they ran, their legs were so long it looked like they were running in slow motion. Then Father said we had to get home before the roads got busy.
This ends Disc 2. The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, Disc 3.
Chapter 139. I like Sherlock Holmes, but I do not like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who was the author of the Sherlock Holmes stories. That is because he wasn't like Sherlock Holmes, and he believed in the supernatural. And when he got old, he joined the Spiritualist Society, which meant that he believed you could communicate with the dead. This was because his son died of influenza during the First World War, and he still wanted to talk to him. And in 1917, something famous happened called the Case of the Cottingley Fairies. Two cousins called Francis Griffiths, who was 9 years old, and Elsie Wright, who was 16 years old, said they used to play with fairies by a stream called Cottingley Beck, and they used Francis's father's camera to take 5 photographs of the fairies. But they weren't real fairies. They were drawings on pieces of paper that they cut out and stood up with pins because Elsie was a really good artist. Harold Snelling, who was an expert in fake photography, said, "These dancing figures are not made of paper, nor any fabric. They are not painted on a photographic background. But what gets me most is that all these figures have moved during the exposure." But he was being stupid, because paper would move during an exposure, and the exposure was very long, because in the photograph you can see a little waterfall in the background, and it's blurred. Then Sir Arthur Conan Doyle heard about the pictures, and he said he believed they were real in an article in a magazine called The Strand. But he was being stupid too, because if you look at the pictures, you can see that the fairies look just like fairies in old books, and they have wings and dresses and tights and shoes, which is like aliens landing on Earth and being like Daleks from Doctor Who or Imperial Stormtroopers from the Death Star in Star Wars or little green men like in cartoons of aliens. And in 1981, a man called Joe Cooper interviewed Elsie Wright and Francis Griffiths for an article in a magazine called The Unexplained. And Elsie Wright said all 5 photographs had been faked, and Francis Griffiths said that 4 had been faked but 1 was real. And they said Elsie had drawn the fairies from a book called Princess Mary's Gift Book by Arthur Shepperson. And this shows that sometimes people want to be stupid, and they do not want to know the truth. And it shows that something called Occam's razor is true. And Occam's razor is not a razor that men shave with, but a law. And it says, "Entia non sunt multiplicanda praeter necessitatem," which is Latin, and it means, no more things should be presumed to exist than are absolutely necessary. Which means that a murder victim is usually killed by someone known to them, and fairies are made out of paper, and you can't talk to someone who is dead. Chapter 149. When I went to school on Monday, Siobhan asked me why I had a bruise on the side of my face. I said that Father was angry and he had grabbed me, so I had hit him, and then we had a fight. Siobhan asked whether Father had hit me, and I said I didn't know because I got very cross and it made my memory go strange. And then she asked if Father had hit me because he was angry, and I said he didn't hit me, he grabbed me, but he was angry. And Siobhan asked if he grabbed me hard, and I said that he had grabbed me hard. And Siobhan asked if I was frightened about going home, and I said I wasn't. And then she asked me if I wanted to talk about it any more, and I said that I didn't. And then she said, okay. And we didn't talk about it any more, because grabbing is okay if it's on your arm or your shoulder when you're angry, but you can't grab someone's hair or their face. But hitting is not allowed, except if you're already in a fight with someone, then it's not so bad. When I got home from school, Father was still at work, so I went into the kitchen and I took the key out of the little china jug shaped like a nun and opened the back door and went outside and looked inside the dustbin to find my book. I wanted to get my book back because I liked writing it. I liked having a project to do, and I liked it especially if it was a difficult project like a book. Also, I still didn't know who had killed Wellington, and my book was where I had kept all the clues that I had discovered, and I did not want them to be thrown away. But my book wasn't in the dustbin. I put the lid back on the dustbin and walked down the garden to have a look in the bin where Father keeps the garden waste, such as lawn clippings and apples that have fallen off the trees, but my book wasn't in there either. I wondered if Father had put it into his van and driven to the tip and put it into one of the big bins there, but I didn't want that to be true, because then I would never see it again. One other possibility was that Father had hidden my book somewhere in the house, so I decided to do some detecting and see if I could find it, except that I had to keep listening really hard all the time so I would hear his van when he pulled up outside the house so he wouldn't catch me being a detective. I started by looking in the kitchen. My book was approximately 25 centimetres by 35 centimetres by 1 centimetre, so it couldn't be hidden in a very small place, which meant that I didn't have to look in any really small places. I looked on top of the cupboards and down the back of the drawers and under the oven, and I used my special maglite torch and a piece of mirror from the utility room to help me see into the dark spaces at the back of the cupboards where the mice used to get in from the garden and have their babies. Then I detected in the utility room. Then I detected in the dining room. Then I detected in the living room, where I found the missing wheel from my Airfix Messerschmitt BF109G6 model under the sofa. Then I thought I heard Father coming through the front door, and I jumped, and I tried to stand up fast, and I banged my knee on the corner of the coffee table, and it hurt a lot, but it was only one of the drug people next door dropping something on the floor. Then I went upstairs, but I didn't do any detecting in my own room, because I reasoned that Father wouldn't hide something from me in my own room unless he was being very clever and doing what's called a double bluff, like in a real murder mystery novel, so I decided to look in my own room only if I couldn't find the book anywhere else. I detected in the bathroom, but the only place to look was in the airing cupboard, and there was nothing in there. Which meant that the only room left to detect in was Father's bedroom. I didn't know whether I should look in there, because he had told me not to mess with anything in his room, but if he was going to hide something from me, the best place to hide it would be in his room. So I told myself I would not mess with things in his room, or would move them and then I would move them back, and he would never know I'd done it, so he wouldn't be angry. I started by looking under the bed. There were 7 shoes and a comb with lots of hair in it and a piece of copper pipe and a chocolate biscuit and a porn magazine called Fiesta and a dead bee and a Homer Simpson pattern tie and a wooden spoon, but not my book. Then I looked in the drawers on either side of the dressing table, but these only contained aspirin and nail clippers and batteries and dental floss and a tampon and tissues and a spare false tooth in case Father lost the false tooth he had to fill the gap where he knocked a tooth out when he fell off the ladder putting a bird box up in the garden, but my book wasn't in there either. Then I looked in his clothes cupboard. This was full of clothes on hangers. There was also a little shelf at the top that I could see onto if I stood on the bed, but I had to take my shoes off in case I left a dirty footprint that would be a clue if Father decided to do some detecting. But the only things on the shelf were more porn magazines and a broken sandwich toaster and 12 wire coat hangers and an old hairdryer that used to belong to Mother. In the bottom of the cupboard was a large plastic toolbox, which was full of tools for doing do-it-yourself, like a drill and a paintbrush and some screws and a hammer. But I could see these without opening the box, because it was made of transparent grey plastic. Then I saw that there was another box underneath the toolbox, so I lifted the toolbox out of the cupboard. The other box was an old cardboard box that's called a shirt box, because people used to buy shirts in them. And when I opened the shirt box, I saw my book was inside. Then I didn't know what to do. I was happy because Father hadn't thrown my book away, but if I took the book, he would know I had been messing with things in his room, and he'd be very angry, and I had promised not to mess with things in his room. Then I heard his van pulling up outside the house, and I knew that I had to think fast and be clever. So I decided that I would leave the book where it was, because I reasoned that Father wasn't going to throw it away if he had put it into the shirt box, and I could carry on writing in another book that I would keep really secret, and then, maybe later, he might change his mind and let me have the first book back again, and I could copy the new book into it. And if he never gave it back to me, I would be able to remember most of what I had written, so I would put it all into the second secret book, and if there were bits I wanted to check to make sure I had remembered them correctly, I could come into his room when he was out and check. Then I heard Father shutting the door of the van, and that was when I saw the envelope. It was an envelope addressed to me, and it was lying under my book in the shirt box with some other envelopes. I picked it up. It had never been opened. It said, Christopher Boone, 36 Randolph Street, Swindon, Wiltshire. Then I noticed that there were lots of other envelopes, and they were all addressed to me. And this was interesting and confusing. And then I noticed how the words Christopher and Swindon were written. They were written with little circles instead of dots over the letter I. I only know 3 people who do little circles instead of dots over the letter I, and one of them is Siobhan, and one of them was Mr. Loxley, who used to teach at the school, and one of them was Mother. And then I heard Father opening the front door, so I took one envelope from under the book, and I put the lid back on the shirt box, and I put the toolbox back on top of it, and I closed the cupboard door really carefully. And Father called out, Christopher! I said nothing, because he might be able to hear where I was calling from. I stood up and walked round the bed to the door, holding the envelope, trying to make as little noise as possible. Father was standing at the bottom of the stairs, and I thought he might see me, but he was flicking through the post which had come that morning, so his head was pointing downwards. Then he walked away from the foot of the stairs towards the kitchen, and I closed the door of his room very quietly and went into my own room. I wanted to look at the envelope, but I didn't want to make Father angry, so I hid the envelope underneath my mattress. Then I walked downstairs and said hello to Father. And he said, So, what have you been up to today, young man? And I said, Today we did life skills with Mrs. Gray, which was using money and public transport, and I had tomato soup for lunch and 3 apples. and I practiced some maths in the afternoon, and we went for a walk in the park with Mrs. Peters and collected leaves for making collages. And Father said, "Excellent, excellent. What do you fancy for chow tonight?" "Chow is food." I said I wanted baked beans and broccoli, and Father said, "I think that can be very easily arranged." Then I sat on the sofa and I read some more of the book I was reading called Chaos by James Glick. Then I went into the kitchen and had my baked beans and broccoli while Father had sausages and eggs and fried bread and a mug of tea. Then Father said, "I'm going to put those shelves up in the living room if that's all right with you. I'll make a bit of a racket, I'm afraid, so if you want to watch television, we're going to have to shift it upstairs." And I said, "I'll go and be on my own in my room." And he said, "Good man." And I said, "Thank you for supper," because that is being polite. And he said, "No problem, kiddo." And I went up to my room. And when I was in my room, I shut the door, and I took out the envelope from underneath my mattress. I held the letter up to the light to see if I could detect what was inside the envelope, but the paper of the envelope was too thick. I wondered whether I should open the envelope, because it was something I had taken from Father's room. But then I reasoned that it was addressed to me, so it belonged to me, so it was okay to open it. So I opened the envelope. Inside there was a letter. And this is what was written in the letter. 451 Chapter Road, Willesden, London, NW25NG, 0208-887-8907. Dear Christopher, I'm sorry it's been such a very long time since I wrote my last letter to you. I've been very busy. I've got a new job working as a secretary for a factory that makes things out of steel. You'd like it a lot. The factory is full of huge machines that make the steel and cut it and bend it into whatever shapes they need. This week, they're making a roof for a cafe in a shopping centre in Birmingham. It's shaped like a huge flower and they're going to stretch canvas over it to make it look like an enormous tent. Also, we've moved into the new flat at last, as you can see from the address. It's not as nice as the old one, and I don't like Willesden very much, but it's easier for Roger to get to work, and he's bought it. He only rented the other one, so we can get our own furniture and paint the walls the colour we want to. And that's why it's been such a long time since I wrote my last letter to you, because it's been hard work packing up all our things and then unpacking them and then getting used to this new job. I'm very tired now, and I must go to sleep, and I want to put this into the letterbox tomorrow morning, so I'll sign off now and write you another letter soon. You haven't written to me yet, so I know that you're probably still angry with me. I'm sorry, Christopher, but I still love you. I hope you don't stay angry with me forever, and I'd love it if you were able to write me a letter, but remember to send it to the new address. I think about you all the time. Lots of love. Your mum. Then I was really confused, because Mother had never worked as a secretary for a firm that made things out of steel. Mother had worked as a secretary for a big garage in the centre of town. And Mother had never lived in London. Mother had always lived with us. And Mother had never written a letter to me before. There was no date on the letter, so I couldn't work out when Mother had written the letter, and I wondered whether someone else had written the letter and pretended to be Mother. And then I looked at the front of the envelope, and I saw that there was a postmark, and there was a date on the postmark, and it was quite difficult to read, but it said, London, 16/10/97, which meant that the letter was posted on 16th October 1997, which was 18 months after Mother had died. And then the door of my bedroom opened, and Father said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm reading a letter." And he said, "I've finished the drilling. That David Attenborough nature program's on telly if you're interested." I said, "Okay." Then he went downstairs again. I looked at the letter and thought really hard. It was a mystery, and I couldn't work it out. Perhaps the letter was in the wrong envelope, and it had been written before Mother had died. But why was she writing from London? The longest she had been away was a week when she went to visit her cousin Ruth, who had cancer, but Ruth lived in Manchester. And then I thought that perhaps it wasn't a letter from Mother. Perhaps it was a letter to another person called Christopher from that Christopher's mother. I was excited. When I started writing my book, there was only one mystery I had to solve. Now there were two. I decided that I wouldn't think about it any more that night, because I didn't have enough information, and you could easily leap to the wrong conclusions, like Mr. Athelney Jones of Scotland Yard, which is a dangerous thing to do, because you should make sure you have all the available clues before you start deducing things. That way you're much less likely to make a mistake. I decided that I would wait until Father was out of the house. Then I would go into the cupboard in his bedroom and look at the other letters and see who they were from and what they said. I folded the letter and hid it under my mattress in case Father found it and got cross. Then I went downstairs and watched the television. Chapter 151. Lots of things are mysteries, but that doesn't mean there isn't an answer to them. It's just that scientists haven't found the answer yet. For example, some people believe in the ghosts of people who have come back from the dead. And Uncle Terry said that he saw a ghost in a shoe shop in a shopping centre in Northampton because he was going down into the basement when he saw someone dressed in grey walk across the bottom of the stairs. But when he got to the bottom of the stairs, the basement was empty and there were no doors. When he told the lady on the till upstairs, they said it was called Tuck and he was a ghost of a Franciscan friar who used to live in the monastery which was on the same site hundreds of years ago, which was why the shopping centre was called Grey Friars Shopping Centre, and they were used to him and not frightened at all. Eventually scientists will discover something that explains ghosts, just like they discovered electricity, which explained lightning. And it might be something about people's brains, or something about the Earth's magnetic field, or it might be some new force altogether. And then ghosts won't be mysteries. They'll be like electricity and rainbows and non-stick frying pans. But sometimes a mystery isn't a mystery. And this is an example of a mystery which isn't a mystery. We have a pond at the school with frogs in, which are there so we can learn how to treat animals with kindness and respect, because some of the children at school are horrible to animals and think it's funny to crush worms or throw stones at cats. And some years there are lots of frogs in the pond, and some years there are very few. And if you drew a graph of how many frogs there were in the pond, the line would ricochet up and down quite irregularly. And if you looked at the graph, you might think that there was a really cold winter in 1987 and 1988 and 1989 and 1997, or that there was a heron which came and ate lots of the frogs. Sometimes there is a heron who comes and tries to eat the frogs, but there's chicken wire over the pond to stop it. But sometimes it's nothing to do with cold winters or cats or herons. Sometimes it's just maths. There is an actual formula for a population of animals, which is n nu equals lambda times the set of n old times the set of 1 minus n old, where n stands for the population density. It was discovered by Robert May and George Oster and Jim York. It can tell you something about when populations will grow or go extinct. And ultimately, it means that sometimes things are so complicated that it's impossible to predict what they're going to do next, but they're only obeying really simple rules. And it means that sometimes a whole population of frogs or worms or people can die for no reason whatsoever, just because that's the way the numbers work. Chapter 157. It was 6 days before I could go back into Father's room to look in the shirt box in the cupboard. On the first day, which was a Wednesday, Joseph Fleming took his trousers off and went to the toilet all over the floor in the changing room and started to eat it, but Mr. Davis stopped him. Joseph eats everything. He once ate one of the little blocks of blue disinfectant which hang inside the toilets. And he once ate a £50 note from his mother's wallet. And he eats string and rubber bands and tissues and writing paper and paints and plastic forks. Also, he bangs his chin and screams a lot. Tyrone said that there was a horse and a pig in the poo, so I said he was being stupid, but Siobhan said he wasn't. They were small plastic animals from the library that the staff used to make people tell stories, and Joseph had eaten them. So I said I wasn't going to go into the toilets because there was poo on the floor, and it made me uncomfortable to think about it, even though Mr. Ennison had come in and cleaned it up. And I wet my trousers, and I had to put on some spare ones from the spare clothes locker in Mrs. Gascoigne's room. So Siobhan said I could use the staff room toilets for 2 days, but only 2 days, and then I'd have to use the children's toilets again. And we made this a deal. On the second, third and fourth days, which were Thursday, Friday and Saturday, nothing interesting happened. On the fifth day, which was a Sunday, it rained very hard. I like it when it rains hard. It sounds like white noise everywhere, which is like silence, but not empty. I went upstairs and sat in my room and watched the water falling in the street. It was falling so hard that it looked like white sparks, and this is a simile too, not a metaphor. And there was no one around because everyone was staying indoors. And it made me think how all the water in the world was connected. And this water had evaporated from the ocean somewhere, in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico or Baffin Bay, and now it was falling in front of the house, and it would drain away into the gutters and flow to a sewage station where it would be cleaned, and then it would go into a river and go back into the ocean again. And in the evening on Monday, Father got a phone call from a lady whose cellar had flooded, and he had to go out and fix it in an emergency. If there's only one emergency, Rodri goes and fixes it, because his wife and children went to live in Somerset, which means he doesn't have anything to do in the evenings apart from playing snooker and drinking and watching the television, and he needs to do overtime to earn money to send to his wife to help her look after the children. And Father has me to look after. But this evening there were two emergencies, so Father told me to behave and to ring him on his mobile phone if there was a problem, and then he went out in the van. So I went into his bedroom and opened up the cupboard and lifted the toolbox off the top of the shirt box and opened the shirt box. I counted the letters. There were 43 of them. They were all addressed to me in the same handwriting. I took one out and opened it. Inside was this letter. 3rd May, 451C Chapter Road, London, NW25NG, 0208-887-8907. Dear Christopher, we have a new fridge and cooker at last. Roger and I drove to the tip at the weekend to throw the old ones away. It's where people throw everything away. There are huge bins for 3 different colours of bottles and cardboard and engine oil and garden waste and household waste and larger items. That's where we put the old fridge and cooker. Then we went to a second-hand shop and bought a new cooker and a new fridge. Now the house feels a little bit more like home. I was looking through some old photos last night, which made me sad. Then I found a photo of you playing with the train set we bought for you a couple of Christmases ago. And that made me happy because it was one of the really good times we had together. Do you remember how you played with it all day, and you refused to go to bed at night because you were still playing with it? And do you remember how we told you about train timetables, and you made a train timetable, and you had a clock, and you made the trains run on time? And there was a little wooden station, too, and we showed you how the people who wanted to go on the train went to the station and bought a ticket and then got on the train. And then we got out a map, and we showed you the little lines which were the train lines connecting all the stations. And you played with it for weeks and weeks and weeks. And we bought you more trains, and you knew where they were all going. I liked remembering that a lot. Oh, I have to go now. It's 3:30 in the afternoon. I know you always like to know exactly what time it is. And I have to go to the co-op and buy some ham to make Roger's tea with. I'll put this letter in the postbox on the way to the shop. Love, your mum. Then I opened another envelope. This was the letter that was inside. Flat 1, 312 Lausanne Road, London, N8 5BV, 0208 756 4321. Dear Christopher, I said that I wanted to explain to you why I went away when I had the time to do it properly. Now I have lots of time, so I'm sitting on the sofa here with this letter and the radio on, and I'm going to try and explain. I was not a very good mother, Christopher. Maybe if things had been different, maybe if you'd been different, I might have been better at it. But that's just the way things turned out. I'm not like your father. Your father's a much more patient person. He just gets on with things, and if things upset him, he doesn't let it show. But that's not the way I am, and there's nothing I can do to change that. Do you remember once when we were shopping in town together? And we went into Bentall's, and it was really crowded, and we had to get a Christmas present for Grandma. And you were frightened because of all the people in the shop. It was the middle of Christmas shopping when everyone was in town. And I was talking to Mr. Land, who works on the kitchen floor and went to school with me. And you crouched down on the floor and put your hands over your ears, and you were in the way of everyone. So I got cross, because I don't like shopping at Christmas either, and I told you to behave, and I tried to pick you up and move you. But you shouted, and you knocked those mixers off the shelf, and there was a big crash, and everyone turned round to see what was going on. And Mr. Land was really nice about it, but there were boxes and bits of broken bowl on the floor, and everyone was staring. And I saw that you'd wet yourself, and I was so cross, and I wanted to take you out of the shop, but you wouldn't let me touch you. And you just lay on the floor and screamed and banged your hands and feet on the floor. And the manager came and asked what the problem was, and I was at the end of my tether, and I had to pay for 2 broken mixers, and we just had to wait until you stopped screaming. And I had to walk you all the way home, which took hours because I knew you wouldn't go on the bus again. And I remember that night I just cried and cried and cried, and your father was really nice about it at first, and he made you supper and he put you to bed, and he said these things happen and it would be okay. But I said I couldn't take it any more. And eventually he got really cross and he told me I was being stupid and said I should pull myself together, and I hit him, which was wrong, but I was so upset. We had a lot of arguments like that, because I often thought I couldn't take it any more. And your father's really patient, but I'm not. I get cross, even though I don't mean to. And by the end, we stopped talking to each other very much, because we knew it would always end up in an argument and it would go nowhere. And I felt really lonely. And that was when I started spending lots of time with Roger. I mean, obviously, we'd always spent lots of time with Roger and Eileen, but I started seeing Roger on his own because I could talk to him. He was the only person I could really talk to. And when I was with him, I didn't feel lonely anymore. And I know you might not understand any of this, but I wanted to try to explain so that you knew. And even if you don't understand now, you can keep this letter and read it later, and maybe you might understand then. And Roger told me that he and Eileen weren't in love with one another anymore, and that they hadn't been in love with one another for a long time, which meant that he was feeling lonely too. So we had a lot in common. And then we realized that we were in love with one another. And he suggested that I should leave your father and that we should move into a house together. But I said that I couldn't leave you, and he was sad about that, but he understood that you were really important to me. And then you and me had that argument. Do you remember? It was about your supper one evening. I'd cooked you something and you wouldn't eat it, and you hadn't eaten for days and days, and you were looking so thin. And you started to shout, and I got cross and threw the food across the room, which I know I shouldn't have done. And you grabbed the chopping board, and you threw it, and it hit my foot and broke my toes. Then, of course, we had to go to the hospital, and I had that plaster put on my foot. And afterwards, at home, your father and I had a huge argument. He blamed me for getting cross with